From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Detroit's been in trouble for a long time. Last week, it threw in the towel, seeking bankruptcy. $18 billion in debt. The city needs to cut big, and it's looking at public pensions. The city's emergency manager says they're $3.5 billion underfunded. Everybody's watching what comes next. And of course, Detroit is not alone. Across the country, the gap between government assets and public pension commitments in many places is wide and growing. This hour on Point, public promises and public pensions. You can join us on air or online with this conversation is always on. How do cities, states, towns keep their promises and stay afloat? Can they? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Yesterday, here's the sound of protesters chanting outside the federal courthouse in Detroit on the first day of hearings into, among other things, whether pensions may be vulnerable under the city's bankruptcy filing.
Help us! Save you!
Help us!
Save you!
Help us!
Save you!
Help us!
Save you!
Help us!
Joining me first today from Washington is Kil Hodd, Director of State and Local Fiscal Health at the Pew Charitable Trusts. He looks at the numbers for public pensions, retiree health care, and more. Kil Hodd, welcome to On Point. Thanks very much for being here.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Listen with us, if you would, to a couple of voices out of Detroit yesterday. Big day there, judge looking at all this. Here's a firefighter, Dennis Hunter, saying it would be unfair to cut public retirees' pensions.
We deserve our pension. This is the American way, and this is going to be an American court decision. And if this judge decides to put our pension in this bankruptcy, he is crushing the American dream.
There's a retiree, a lot on the line for him and many others. And here, the emergency manager of the city of Detroit, Kevin Orr, talking on Fox News Sunday with Chris Wallace, saying, don't have a choice.
We don't have a choice. We've crossed the Rubicon on the level. We have 18 plus, 18 to $19 billion in debt and no funding mechanism for it. So this is question of necessity.
Kil Hodd in Washington, at this point, is it clear or what are the odds that public pensions will be put under the knife in Detroit?
It's a real possibility because, as Kevin Orr stated, Detroit has run out of options. Essentially, they've been kicking the can down the road with their pensions as well as other obligations. Again, you have to remember, if Kevin Orr's numbers are right, the $3.5 million in unfunded pension liabilities
billion,
is just
billion.
A billion, I'm sorry, mm-hmm. is just a piece of the debt that Detroit has to work out. Detroit for a long time has been living beyond its means and not really putting the money forward to sort of take care of these long-term liabilities. And the $3.5 billion unfunded pensions estimate by Kevin Orr, along with the $15 to $16 billion in other outstanding debts, is crushing Detroit.
How can there be such a wide swing in how much they're really underfunded? I mean, I think the city's number was something like $650 million. Then he comes along and says $3.5 billion. Others have said publicly $9 billion related to retirees. How can there be such a big, it's more than wiggle room?
Well, I mean, part of the challenge might be that, Detroit has in the past borrowed to cover its pension obligations. In 2005, it issued what's called a pension obligation bond, essentially money that they borrowed to put back into the financial markets to cover their bills, but then to also earn to earn some return so that they could be in a better funding position going forward. Part of what Detroit also needed to do was put aside their annual contribution that their actuaries recommend, and that's something that Detroit has consistently failed to do. So, the combination of borrowing to pay for promises that have already been made and benefits that have already been earned, along with persistent underfunding year after year, is really what drove Detroit to where it is now.
Is it a choice between paying back the lenders, the bondholders, and cutting back on the pensioners?
That's just two choices. Cutting back on pension benefits, promises that they've already earned, as well as not fully paying back your investors, are just two choices that Kevin Orr, as well as the bankruptcy judge, will now have to make. They also have to worry about putting police officers on the streets, picking up trash, cleaning streets, as well as turning on the lights, which is a real problem for Detroit.
I mean, I'm looking here at numbers that say the average pension, city pension in New York, is $19,000. That is by no means super generous. What's to cut in a $19,000 pension?
Well, they're trying to basically figure out not only annual cost, but cost going forward, because, you know, $19,000 over a 30-year period can really add up for Detroit. And, you know, these problems are immediate for Detroit, but they're also going to play out over the long term. And what they're trying to do is essentially get a handle on these long-term obligations, not just on the pension side, but on the borrowing that they've engaged in, and really hit the reset button. You know, bankruptcy is a measure of last resort for any municipality. You know, there's a real stigma as well as cost attached to bankruptcy. It's essentially a signal to not only the taxpayers and businesses that reside in the city, but to the bond markets as well, that they couldn't fix their own problems.
Could you explain, I mean, I'm reading with some of these pensioners, public retirees, that because they're public retirees, they don't have Social Security. Their public pension is all they have. Do you know for what portion of Detroit retirees that's the case, and around the country, for what portion of state, city, local, town retirees that's the case?
It's difficult to find a good estimate in terms of how many people, how many public sector workers are not covered by Social Security. But in Detroit alone, I know that the police and firefighters are not covered by Social Security. So those choices are even more difficult. There is no other benefit aside from their pensions that will help them in retirement. And when you cut benefits, you're also going to impose other costs that right now, you know, the emergency manager as well as future elected officials are not really thinking about. You know, these people might need other forms of assistance, which also cost money, and that's not really being factored into the calculus. But with respect to the police and fire workers, the fact that they don't have Social Security, there is no safety net under them, that makes the choices very, very difficult for any judge really looking at sort of what to do with this pension liability that they have.
What are the precedents here around the country? Are there other cities or government entities that have gone to bankruptcy and cut public pensions, just done it?
Well, recently, Central Falls, Rhode Island, just came out of their bankruptcy. It was one of the fastest bankruptcy processes in recent history. What they did, though, was to protect the bondholders. The state did that, at least, and essentially assure that they would get back 100% of their promised investment. On the other hand, they cut pension benefits, and the court upheld this to basically balance their budgets moving forward. They also drastically cut services to the residents of Central Falls and, you know, increased taxes. On the other hand, when you look at Vallejo, another high-profile
California.
In California, mm-hmm. Exactly. What they did there was to completely sort of protect their pensioners and continue to fully fund those benefits, but then cut services drastically. You know, when Vallejo was in bankruptcy in California, many residents fled because the services have just been cut drastically and taxes are starting to rise. So it's very tough for policymakers to weigh the choices that they have before them when they've come to this point.
Bankruptcy makes all kinds of things possible. Here's former judge Robert Flanders, who worked with Central Falls, Rhode Island, talking with CBS News. This is in March of last year. Took the city into Chapter 9 bankruptcy and saying here that as difficult as it was, they had to cut pensions.
In Chapter 9, you can do things that are impossible to do outside of it. Restructure your pension obligations, blow up contracts on day one. So the savings begin immediately. For Central Falls to put pensions on the table and to go after them as part of a restructuring effort is going to be a very important precedent as other cities and towns think about how do we restructure things.
This must send a shudder down the spines of many retirees, public retirees around the country hearing that, looking at Detroit. I mean, in Michigan, and in, not only Michigan, but in Michigan, the state constitution says they will not, they will not fail to fulfill their pension commitments. What kind of protection is that, Kill?
Well, this is the situation that they're in. For years, they've kicked the can down the road and they've ignored the bill coming due. And finally, they ran out of road and now they're confronted with a very tough decision where they have very little money to honor their obligations to their retirees as well as their investors and then also the taxpayers that live there. You know, these are extraordinary circumstances and, you know, this is symptomatic of a problem of all cities really living beyond their means in some cases. There are plenty of examples of cities and states that consistently fund their annual required contribution for their pensions and have fully funded plans. And so defined benefits can work for some states.
What percentage of public employees or states, cities, and local towns in this country are in trouble on the pension front? I mean, I'm looking here at $1 trillion in described as a shortfall in funding for pensions. What does that amount to in terms of what portion of our communities or states that are up against this?
Well, it varies across the country. I mean, you have some really well-funded states and cities. New York is an extremely well-funded state, as is North Carolina, and they have defined benefit plans. But they've also kept an eye on the level of benefits going forward, and they've also been very, very disciplined about putting aside the money that they needed year after year.
We know it varies, but what portion of the country's states, cities, towns are in trouble?
Well, I mean, there's really no way to perfectly measure, you know, how many states or cities are confronting pension challenges because, you know, especially at this moment after they've lived through one of the worst economic downturns. I mean, they will need some time to sort of catch up with some of the asset losses that they experienced in the Great Recession. And you know, I want to emphasize that this is a long-term problem. So for Detroit, this was a long time in the making and not something that just developed overnight. And that's an important point to get across.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about Detroit's bankruptcy, public pensions nationally, and how we'll pay what we've promised, whether we will pay. Kiel Huz with us from the Pew Charitable Trusts. We're going to hear more voices in just a moment. This was Michigan's Governor Rick Snyder on Sunday on CBS's Face the Nation. He talked to what he saw might be the pension future for the 20,000 people in Detroit who are retired on municipal pensions.
That's one of the other tragic situations of this, that your heart has to go out to anyone, these retirees that worked hard for the city, they're on a fixed income. There is a challenge there. But what I would say is the bankruptcy process allows us to do it in a much thoughtful, more deliberate, better way where they can have a voice at the table. During the process that we've been going through about talking to creditors, no one wanted to represent the retirees. So proactively, in the bankruptcy petition we put in, we've asked the judge to put together a group of retirees, someone to represent the retirees so they can have a voice at the table.
They may have a voice at the table. Will they have their pensions, their full pensions? And it's not just Detroit. It's not just in Michigan. Here was a June 13th interview with PBS Chicago's In the Loop. And Illinois' Governor Pat Quinn talked, their Democratic governor, about the immediate need for pension reform in Illinois. He said, called on state legislatures to step up and pass it quick.
What's at stake here is our economy in Illinois, the future of our children and our education. It's time for them to do their job. There's unfinished business by the legislature. They've got to put a pension reform measure on my desk. I've given them the outline of how to do it. I've given them the specifics of what's in it, and it's time for them to act.
Reform still has not been passed in Illinois. In early July, Quinn suspended pay for Illinois lawmakers until pension reform is dealt with. You can see it's getting serious. Kilha, please stand by in Washington. With us right now from Washington as well is Monique Morrissey. She's economist for the Economic Policy Institute, formerly worked for the AFL-CIO. Monique Morrissey, thank you very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
And with us from Wilson, Connecticut is Bob Posen, senior lecturer at Harvard Business School, fellow at the Brookings Institution, former chairman of MFS Investment Management, former member of President George W. Bush's Commission to Strengthen Social Security, author of Too Big to Save, How to Fix the U.S. Financial System. Bob Posen, thank you for joining us. Welcome back to On Point.
Thank you for having me.
We're going to hear Monique out. We're going to hear everybody out here. But, Bob, you are on the record saying, can't be done. We can't pay all this. Really? What has to be cut? Does it really have to be cut?
Well, first of all, it's not only the pension liabilities. If we look at Detroit, the unfunded retiree benefits are actually twice as large as the pensions.
Including what? Health care?
That's mainly health care, health care. So on the retiree health care, we can do more because, first of all, legally it's more flexible. And then we can ask retirees to go on Medicare. And as Obamacare comes in, they can use the state connectors. So there's more that can be done in that area. In the pension fund area, the judge is going to have to, the bankruptcy judge probably will refer it to the state Supreme Court to see what this so-called constitutional protection is.
So-called? It's pretty explicit, isn't it?
It is very explicit, and I think it's going to be very relevant. But we need to think about retirees in three groups. There are the people already retired, and they should have the strongest rights. New workers, you can usually have a new bargain with them. And then you have the current employees who are accruing benefits and have some already accrued. Things that you can do, you can change the number of years that people have to serve before they're eligible for retirement. You can have the retirement payments based on, say, the average of the last 10 years, then the average of the last 2 years. So that would give you a more gradual number, and you have cost of living adjustments. So all of these things are being tried in various states, but legally, sometimes they work and sometimes they don't, and politically, they're obviously all very explosive.
Monique, the emergency administrator in Detroit, Kevin Orr, says pensions have to be on the table. What do you say to that, Monique?
Well, pensions have already been on the table. The public sector unions accepted large cuts in pensions for current workers. They've seen 40% cuts in the benefit at the end of retirement, and also a cut in the COLA. So, and this is actually something that's been happening around the country. The Center for Retirement Research in Boston recently estimated that the pensions that it looked at, pensions cuts had already made up for the decline in asset values from the 2008 financial market decline.
Nationally, so, or just in Detroit, or where?
In all the pensions that they looked at, and they looked at a wide cross-section. So they didn't look at every single pension, but in general. And this has been my experience, too. There have been very dramatic cuts in pensions. So what's at stake here, really, the issue is one that Robert Posen mentioned, is, you know, the current, whether you can cut pensions for current retirees, people who've already, you know, who are already retired. Mm-hmm. And historically, this was considered a line you didn't cross. In the private sector, it's protected by law. The PBG, you know, if a company goes bankrupt, the PBGC picks up the benefits, and
or some portion thereof,
or some, yeah. But they would all be covered in this case, because it's only very high pensions that might be only partially covered. And also just they're protected under ERISA. In the public sector, it varies by state. And in fact, Michigan was considered to have one of the strongest protections with this constitutional protection. So what's happening that's brand new is this attempt by, in some places, to try to actually get at the pensions of people who are already retired, which is really rather shocking. I mean, it's somebody who's already collecting a pension, who's already done the work. And I would like to emphasize, who accepted lower pay, much lower pay, and often made significant contributions to those pensions out of pocket. So typically, public sector employees pay a good share of their own pensions out of pocket. And they also typically are paid less than equivalently educated people in the private sector. So they've already done the work. They took lower pay. They contributed to these pensions. And then we're saying, oh, well, sorry, we didn't, you know, we're just going to take some of this back. And that's what's really sort of that, and the fact that it's a large city that's declaring bankruptcy. But those are the two things that make Detroit, big news.
Monique, what do you think should happen if and when a city or town or state just comes up against it and it's time to pay the pensions and the money's just not there? What should happen in that case?
Well, I disagree that the money is not necessarily there. We should take with a large grain of salt the emergency manager's estimates. These are guesstimates, as it's been the way it's been described, and I would say that's a pretty good way to put it. Nobody has actually been able to look at the numbers, and as was mentioned earlier, all of a sudden the pension obligations were inflated from about $640 million to $3.5 billion. And I think Kilha said earlier that he thought that this had to do with that they were probably lumping in the pension obligation bonds. Nobody really knows. There's actually kind of an interesting debate among people who follow municipal bonds. And so we're not talking about the union world. We're talking about the bond
world. I don't know if
they
accurate.
Think those numbers are exaggerated.
Maybe. But so, what would the incentive be to exaggerate the unfunded pension liability? What would the incentive be, Monique?
Oh, they have a huge incentive.
What would it be? Explain it.
Well, because if you're declaring bankruptcy and you're trying to cut pensions against a, you know, a constitutional guarantee, you have to make it seem as if you can't possibly, you don't have any choice at all. So if you want to do that, you have to exaggerate. And it's done all over the place. I mean, it's not, this is not the first time. I mean, it's, for example, in Rhode Island, you know, the treasurer in Rhode Island, before cutting the pensions there, you know, put out a report that was taken at face value, but should never have been, you know, saying that the problems in that Rhode Island faced had to do with accounting, you know, rosy accounting assumptions and things like that, and it really didn't hold up. What she was doing was, for example, comparing the assumed rate of return that the pension fund was assuming with recent rates of return, which by everybody agrees have been really low. I mean, it's been a very rocky decade.
Still, that's so a pretty big deal when it comes to accumulating the assets. Stand by, Monique. Bob Posen, you said that the problem is not exaggeration of pension liabilities, but deep inaccuracy in projected funds to be available.
Well, I think that the one point that's really critical in the calculation of pension liabilities is what's called the discount rate, which has to do with how much a pension fund, if it invests very conservatively, is likely to return.
8% is often the presumption that's baked in the accounting.
And you wouldn't, 8% is the number that's used by most public pension funds. But if you look at the corporate world, they have been required to use the AA rate, which today is about 3 or 4%. And the accounting for public pension funds has only been modified in the last year or two. So, unfortunately, the difference between $650 million and $3 billion, part of that is on what's assumed as a rate of return.
Monique says that's just a fluke, that sub 8% return, and things will balance out.
I think if we look at the long-term 10-year Treasury rate, it's about 5%. So I agree with her. We shouldn't use 2%, but we shouldn't use 8%. If we use something like 5% or maybe 5.5%, then that's a more realistic number for how much money a pension fund can return with a very low risk.
And if I may,
pension funds have been doing that.
Yeah, Kilha, do we have a problem around the country of rosy scenarios that are masking problems?
Well, I think the states are taking a close look. States and cities are taking a close look at their expected rate of return. In fact, you've seen some lower their discount rate. In California specifically, they revised those discount rate numbers and increased
the discount from 8% to 7.5%.
Yeah, and
7.75%.
Yeah, that's right. And
still
it drove
high.
That small change drove a significant increase in the unfunded liability. I would say, like, it's very difficult to figure out whether or not, you know, this conversation should center around the discount rate, though, because there are plenty of plans across the country that assume 7.5%, maybe 8% expected rate of return and are extremely well funded. North Carolina, Georgia, as well as New York. I think what's key here is that they've manage those projections and expectations very well. They've set aside the money year after year, even when returns have come up short, to basically cover those bills moving forward, because they essentially, you know, know how critical these promises are to the people who are counting on them in the future.
And good for them having done that. Of course, the problem is not every municipality or state has done that. Detroit clearly in trouble here. Kilha, Bob Posen, Monique Morrissey, please stand by. With us right now from Detroit is John Day, retired police detective for the Detroit Police Department. John Day, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you, Tom, for having me.
Do you take the threat to your pension as real, as serious? Do you think it may really be put on the table?
Oh, I think it's already on the table. If you look at the restructuring proposal they've already proposed, they want significant cuts to retirees' pensions.
I don't want to get too personal, but you're already out there a little bit publicly. What is the size of your Detroit pension, John?
I receive $2,900 a month.
So it's not exactly lavish. How much cut could you take in that, if any?
None.
And how do you feel as a how long did you work as a policeman? How do you feel about this conversation about cutting it?
Well, you know, this conversation, I worked over 26 years. The whole conversation is the numbers they put forth. I know you're talking about the discount rate. But the numbers they put forth in the proposal, I'd like to ask your other guests, what's the typical amortization period for the pension plans around the country?
Bob Posen, can you speak to that?
Well, I think that the funding of most public pension funds, on average, is something like 80%. And the ones that are low, like Illinois, the state in Illinois passed a law saying that it was going to contribute so much a year, and it just never did it. And that's why they're in deep trouble. I think, Tom, when you get to a point like Detroit, there are no good choices. The key is to start working on this in advance. And we have lots of pension funds that could go either way in states and cities. So they need to get their expected returns down a little. They need to meet their contribution requirements. They need to look at their cost of living. They need to do all these things and get it into order. Unfortunately, once you get to the point that Detroit is, there are no good choices left.
John Day, in Detroit, the Michigan Constitution is supposed to protect public pensions. Do you believe it will do that?
I believe it's definitely a 10th Amendment issue. I mean, you have the governor of the state took an oath to defend the Michigan Constitution, and he hurried, when there was a lawsuit challenging him in Lansing, while they were waiting for his counsel to appear in court, they electronically filed the bankruptcy, which I think is just absolutely dishonest. He dishonored his office. That's basically how I feel. And I think that there's been numerous things that they've put into the media that are not accurate. I mean, they're grossly inflating their pension liability. Now, I understand our assumed rate of return is 8%. It was just changed several years ago at the city's request. It used to be 7%. Our latest actuarial report reports our fund, the police and fire, at 96% funded. Now, based on an assumed rate of return of 8% and a amortization period of 29 years closed.
Why would they be going after pensions then, John? How do you read this?
Well, I read this. They want to shed their liability. They want to shed the city's liability. I mean, if you haven't been to Detroit recently, I mean, we've had real estate speculators and business people from all over the country buying up everything that's not nailed down. And in 30 years, I've never seen this much investment in the city. And they're coming and buying a skyscraper for $1 million. And I really do believe that they thought that all the liabilities would be shed and that their tax rates would come way down on property taxes. I mean, the city doesn't collect 50% of their property taxes.
What is it a choice between coming after you and coming after bondholders, cutting out bondholders who expected a return, John? Is that the deal?
Oh, yeah, definitely. Absolutely. And a lot of the bondholders, I mean, it wasn't mom and pop buying these bonds. I mean, if they did due diligence and they came into the city, they could see what they were buying.
Yeah.
And now
we got a mess and not a lot of money. John Day, former police detective in Detroit, his pension may be on the line here. John, we appreciate you being with us for a few minutes. Thanks so much for being here.
Okay. Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about Detroit's bankruptcy, public pensions nationally, and how we will pay what we've promised, whether we'll pay. Kil Hudd's with us from the Pew Charitable Trust in Washington, director of state and local fiscal health reporting there, all over the issue of pensions. Monique Morrissey's with us from the Economic Policy Institute, formerly at the AFL-CIO, and Bob Posen's here, former chairman of MFS Investment Management, now a lecturer at Harvard Business School, and paying a lot of attention to what's going on with pensions as well. Let's go to Chicago. Big issues there. Daryl's calling from Chicago. Daryl, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yes.
Very interesting topic that you all are discussing today. It just really troubles me that the American society is in trouble. I mean, the public distrust of officials are at an all-time high. We have the worst economic situation that we could ask for. And we depend on constitutions and laws and regulations to govern our society. And it just troubles me that people are hiding behind years of, you know, change of offices and different positions and different people. But these things are mandated by constitutions and regulations and laws.
But, Daryl, I hear you loud and clear, but doesn't it also depend on having the money and the economy to produce it?
Well, how can you say that you're going to have the money and you're going to put the money where it's supposed to go? And we can clearly see that some of these cities and places that we're talking about, institutions, elected not to put the money there. They had the money and chose to spend it on something else.
Yeah, Daryl, I appreciate your call from Chicago very much. I mean, Monique, let me put it to you. A couple of perspectives on this. You know, on the one hand, here's one of our listeners, Rosemary, on Twitter. She says, cheating pensioners in retirement is a choice, funneling money to 1% instead of keeping it with the 99%. There's one perspective. On the other hand, we've seen Walter Russell Mead writing that this is what he calls a blue model of American governance. Promise more than you can pay, get elected on those promises, and then just shove the consequences down the road. What about those two angles, very different angles on what's going on here, Monique?
Well, I think that there are some places where that's true. And in fact, the caller from Chicago, in Illinois, there's no question that they were living, you know, this is a city that's not in dire straits in other ways. You know, it's a thriving city, and yet they were not paying in. And there's a sort of statewide problem in Illinois of bad government. Mm-hmm. In Michigan, that's not clear at all to me that that's what happened. I mean, we keep repeating it as if it's a fact that they weren't paying in. But what really happened, the big problem is you had the 2008 downturn. But if you have a city that's shrunk dramatically because of deindustrialization, because, yep, you know, the population moving to the suburbs and similar reasons, you have a shrinking tax base. And so any liabilities that you have all of a sudden loom much larger. It's not, you know, it's been repeated several times that they weren't paying in. And it's actually, that's not clear from the history at all. In fact, it's Detroit pensions historically were doing surprisingly well. And I want to emphasize, too, and Robert Posen earlier mentioned this. I mean, overall, what we have is we have $4 trillion nationwide in pension liabilities, and we have $3 trillion in assets. And so we have $1 trillion in unfunded liabilities, most of which happened after the 2008 downturn. And then in most places, we have 30 years to pay them back. And if you look at this as a percentage of public revenues, it's actually quite small. So it sounds really big. Mm-hmm. You know, we're only three quarters funded. Well, actually, historically, we were much, much worse off in earlier decades. The fact that we are that well funded, especially in the wake of a major economic downturn, is not really that bad. It's been blown up out of proportion to make people, you know, to justify drastic cuts. And those cuts have already happened. But now we're starting to, you know, go beyond cutting pay and benefits and things
Let me take it to Bob Posen. And Bob, okay, you hear Monique's angle on this. Paul Krugman, writing on this recently, says, you know, hey, look, you know, $16 trillion economy, this is all manageable. He says, Krugman writes, the important thing is not to let the discussion get hijacked Greek style. There are influential people out there who would like you to believe that Detroit's demise is fundamentally a tale of fiscal irresponsibility and or greedy employees. It isn't. It's just a changing economy. And here we are. Let's get together and help them out, says Krugman. What do you say to that, Bob?
Well, I think the first thing is we have to have accurate accounting. What Walter Mead said was, it's easy when you have bad accounting, and we've had bad accounting for years in public pensions and public retiree health, to hide how much this is costing, and therefore the politicians don't have to deal with it, and they say later on. So whether you use a 5% rate or a 6% rate makes a huge difference versus an 8% rate. And if you just move 8 to 7.5, you're not realistic, because if we look at the long-term markets conservatively invested, it's in the 5 to 6. But as long as we have bad accounting, no one has an incentive to do it.
But what about Monique's argument? Look, over 30 years and you've got time, pensions don't get paid all at once. Just settle down. This can be worked out.
Well, the $3 trillion, it depends on Exactly. It depends on making contributions and investing them wisely. So some of that gap can be made up. But if it makes it, it all depends on whether new contributions are made by the public entities in a timely manner. That hasn't happened. And second of all, what's a reasonable assumption to make about investment returns? And in many states, Illinois is clearly one where they haven't been making the contributions. But it's not so easy over 30 years to make up $1 trillion unless you invest aggressively. And what we see is public pension funds are putting more money into hedge funds and private equity funds, and that bothers me.
Because of the risk.
Yes. How much can you... How much can, of that $1 trillion can you make up over 30 years if you invest in long-term treasuries or AAA bonds? That's really what we want to see. And the answer is that we can make up some of it, but we can't make up all of it. And some of it has to be made by contributions. And contributions now, politicians want to leave it to the future. The other thing, remember, retiree health care obligations are actually larger than public pension funds. If we looked at the Pew statistics, they say that for the 50 largest cities, it's about $20 billion larger retiree health care. And retiree health care does not require any funding. There's no advance funding in almost any city or a state government.
Wow.
So that's another thing we need to change. We need to get everyone onto Medicare or Obamacare, or alternatively, we need to start funding it. Remember, we haven't funded that at all. I think the average funding is either zero to 5%.
That's scary.
In the pension fund, we're at least funding it. It depends on these assumptions. We're not trying to fund it in retiree health care.
Get it out there somewhere. D, Kilha, I want to come to you. Let me get a caller here first. D in South Hadley, Massachusetts. D, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
My suggestion for solving this problem would be to have the judge decree that anybody that wants to get 100% on their pension must reside in the city of Detroit. That way there it expands the tax base, takes care of some of that vacant property that they have that they went ahead from Detroit. And, you could possibly take and have the city get a hold of some of that property and discount it to the people that are coming back.
D, we've got it. Stick around if you want your pension. Kilha, what about it? What are Detroit's options here? You hear Dee's suggestion there, make people stay and live here and be in the tax base. And what about nationally? How do we need radical solutions, or can we tweak the investments and this all falls back in line?
I think it varies across the country in terms of what the solutions are. Just to get to a point made earlier, Detroit's pension funds, at least on paper, were well-funded. But that was also driven by a large pension obligation bond that they issued in 2005.
That is
borrowed. Yeah, that's borrowing. And what that borrowing allowed the city to do is essentially reduce their annual payments moving forward. But it's still debt, exactly. So you have to pay them. And so I can't underestimate the bad choices that were made by some of the elected officials along the way and exacerbated what was already massive structural issues, economic structural issues that the state and the city were confronting. OPEB or retiree health care, other pension obligations, other post-employment benefits rather, are a huge issue for many of the municipalities as well as states across the country. And Bob was absolutely right. They're only about 5% funded. But there is some flexibility in terms of what you can do with those bills coming due. But, we're about to face a huge demographic bubble. Traditionally, states and cities have paid for these on a pay-as-you-go basis. And as the number of retirees swell, especially in the public sector, but just, nationally, it's going to be another huge budget pressure for states and cities to confront.
Bob Posen, I pressed Kilha on, what portion of states, cities are in trouble here, and he's not really prepared to put a number on that. So I think for listeners, it may be hard to sort of suss out what the odds are that they've got problems in their town or the scale across the country. How do you see it?
Well, there's no exact number, but I think that I would say this, that you have something like 80% of all cities and states which have a substantial funding gap. And that's under current accounting, which in my view underestimates the gap. So, therefore, I would say that, you know, the cities and states that are really well-funded are the minority. Unfortunately, whether it's 80% or 75%, it's the substantial majority that have underfunding in pensions and almost no funding in retiree health care. And all those things, I agree with Monique, it's a long-term problem. But in order to use the long-term, we've got to start now. The problem is every politician figures he'll put it off or she'll put it off. So if we start now and have more realistic investment assumptions, if we start now and have the public entities make the contributions, mm-hmm. if we start now and slow the growth of obligations, then we can get to the right place. But if we don't do that now, 20 years from now, it'll be much worse.
Jay in Savannah, Georgia. Jay, thanks for calling. You're on.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I was just thinking, wouldn't it be nice if, you know, some of those businesses that we bailed out, like the car companies and the banks, came and bailed us out? I mean, they took taxpayer money to get bailed out of their financial woes. It'd be nice if they came through and bailed out the taxpayer.
Well, it would be nice if somebody could come along and do it. That'd be awesome. Monique, I mean, at a certain point, you wonder, though, if we've got a shell game going here and, you know, we keep moving things around, but there's not really enough to keep it all going.
That's the allegation that there's rosy assumptions and that people have been playing games and putting things off. But actually, I don't believe that at all. I actually part of my job, which is incredibly mm-hmm. boring, is looking through actuarial valuations. And for example, if you look at what they were assuming in Detroit, yes, they were assuming 7.9% returns, which sounds high now, but actually, you know, historically has been pretty much, in fact, often it's lower than what pension funds received. And they're now assuming that, for example, wages are going to keep rising 4% a year. Well, they just saw big wage cuts. And a lot of what the pension liabilities, which, by the way, are not legal liabilities because they're based on wage projections, a big part of these so-called liabilities are assuming that people's wages are going to keep rising. And they're assumed to be rising at 4%. So, you know, you can if you look at the
but if they're not rising, that suggests a bad economy. That suggests you may not get your 7.9%. I mean,
yeah, but the thing is that you can't point to one part of it and not another part of it. I mean, a big part of what's, you know, the amount they're trying to set aside money now to pay for future pensions. And so you need to come up with reasonable assumptions. And they're using long-term assumptions, and they're being criticized based on short-term returns. And then everyone says, oh, well, you know, and there's this philosophical thing where they are saying, well, because we don't really know, we'll have to use, this is what, this is the argument being made by Robert Posen and some other people, what we should be using is, you know, the return on safe bonds. But these are not invested in risk-free bonds, and no one's telling 401k investors to invest in those bonds, because really it's a very, very conservative assumption. I mean, you can say that pension funds are, you know, should be investing slightly more conservatively or not, but most people would say they should be investing in a balanced portfolio. And the discount rate that people are arguing should be used is not based on a balanced portfolio, but is based on ultra conservative financing.
Yeah,
and
yeah,
so,
yeah.
You know, I don't think that's, I strongly dispute that. Now, I think Kilha had a very good point about the borrowing that, you know, nobody really knows how they came up with this $3.5 billion, but they probably did lump in the pension obligation bonds. But again, I would argue that the focus is on pensions because that was what was shortchanged. But that doesn't mean that pensions are the problem. It just meant in general, you know, if you're not paying your electricity bill, it doesn't mean your electricity bill is too high.
If I may,
and
our
so
time is
was,
almost
you know,
out here, Monique. We've got it. Kilha, I want to come to you. I mean, do you see manageable issues in cities and states that have these problems or issues that are going to require some kind of radical solution, Kilha?
Well, I think it's important to note, as Monique related earlier, that for the last 5 years now, states and cities have been trying to actively deal with their long-term issues. You know, both on the pension and retiree healthcare side, with the types of reforms that they've enacted to, you know, reducing benefits for new employees and adjusting them as they've gone along, as well as requiring sometimes employees to contribute more to their own retirement and health care. They've also, you know, taken a close look at what they've borrowed, their spending, they've increased taxes. And so they're trying to right the ship all over the country.
Detroit's going bankrupt. That doesn't sound too righted.
But I think that there are Detroits out there. There are Detroits, Vallejos, there are Central Falls, Jefferson counties. There are cities that, and in some cases states, if you look at you know, Michigan and its economic woes, it's turning around, but it still has a lot of pain to sort of get through, you know, that really have run out of road to maneuver. And that's the challenge for them. And, you know, again, I just emphasize that bankruptcy is a measure of last resort for a lot of these cities.
If these pensions get cut and benefits get cut, are they still going to have people willing to step forward and work for cities and states, Kill?
I mean, that's the question. I mean, as bankruptcy plays out, our business is going to want to locate there. Our residents are going to want to live there. Are people going to want to work for the city? That's a huge concern for states and localities.
Well, I'm grateful to all three of you for helping us work through this. And John Day in Detroit, former policeman there who joined us, former retired police detective. We've got a lot to pay attention to, and hopefully before it gets to Detroit's situation. Monique Morrissey with the Economic Policy Institute in Washington, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you, Tom.
Robert Posen in Wilson, Connecticut. Bob, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
And Kilha at the Pew Charitable Trusts in Washington. Listeners, thank you, Kil. Listeners, thanks
thank
very
you.
Much for being with us. Tomorrow, News of the Week in Review. Join us for that. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.